Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. What an honor to again be with the great Paul Ekman, our friend, the doctor, the many things. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be together with Paul Ekman here in Vancouver, British Columbia, in the great country Canada. We went away talking about both the environment that included saber-toothed tigers and the environment that could be either functional or dysfunctional, and you would carry that script forward unless you had finished that work and gone out to be free of that script. The notion of environment is so fundamental to understanding the Darwinian approach to life, to all things. I have found Darwin to be, the whole Darwinian concept, which I guess we say is the new Darwinian synthesis, to be fundamentally liberating for me in thinking about virtually everything. It gives me data, it gives me perspective, it helps me understand who I am in the context in which I find myself. It's been profound to come to that kind of, and I probably have only scratched the surface. The Darwinian process and the environmental issue of which we were just speaking is at the heart of what I perceive in the work that you did in going back and really thinking hard about the expression of emotions in men and animals. Can we go back to the Darwinian part of this? Because you are, sure, above all people I can think of, are as close to helping me think my way further into this Darwinian thinking as I can imagine. And to me, it is essential to understanding everything.
I stand on Darwin's shoulders, and I hope it's not too uncomfortable for him.
He has passed, yes. So it's okay.
Although I did have one dream in which we had a conversation, and he said to me, I really appreciate all that you've done on this new edition of my expression book, which has been largely ignored for the last 100 years, which it has been. And Darwin was a scrupulous bookkeeper of his royalties. You know, he made a fortune on the sales of his books. And the expression book did extremely well when it was first published. I mean, you think of the title, The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals. You couldn't come up with a more popular title. It sold 7,000 copies in the first 3 months in London.
In
1872.
That's a lot of
That's
books.
A lot of books. And but in the 20th century, and if it sold very little, and because it had a view of that there was a large biological, genetically transmitted, that what we do reflects in some sense the wisdom of the ages. What has been preserved and useful for the survival of the species when we were hunters and gatherers, which was 95% the time we were on this planet. Well, that was very anti-Lockean.
As in John Locke.
And John Locke, the tabula rasa. And both in the West, the belief, the reification of the family. The state creates the family creates the person. It isn't your children. You can make silk purses out of sow's ears. Your children all come into the world for you to shape and create. Well, we now know that's not true, but for more than 100 years, and not just in the West. I mean, that was the Soviet view as well, because the state makes the person, controls the family, makes the person. So Darwin was considered, was quite unpopular and relatively ignored for the expression book. When I entered the scene, this was about 1965, went through serendipity, not because I sought it, not because I wanted to do cross-cultural work, but a program manager in the Defense Department who had been supporting my work on threats. I was quite interested in the nature of threats. So I'm not going to support that anymore. What else are you doing? I said, well, you know, you won't be interested. No, tell me. I said, well, I'm studying gestures and expression in mental patients. He said, you know, I'm married to a woman from Thailand, and we're having a lot of marital problems, and I think it's cross-cultural misunderstanding. How would you like to have the money to study gestures and expressions all over the world. Find out what's similar and what's different. It's his idea, not mine.
Would that be yes, please?
No, I said, I'll think about it. Because I wasn't trained in anthropology, so I went back to San Francisco and decided I'm not going to, I know how to study mental patients. I'm going to keep doing that. So he called me on the phone and he says, how's the proposal coming? I said, I decided not to do it. He said, I'll see you tomorrow. He flew out. He sat down at the typewriter. He wrote the proposal. This is 1965. Gave me close to $1 million. The conditions were really simple. One, you have to spend at least half of the year out of the country yourself. Can't subcontract it. Two, it has to be basic research with no military application. Very tough conditions to meet.
That was it?
That was it.
Okay.
So now I have the problem facing me. I knew Margaret Mead. I had studied her. I had never read Darwin. Nobody read Darwin in the 1950s when I was a graduate student. I knew about it. I knew he was wrong. And
So you didn't bother?
I didn't bother. So I set out to try to do it. And the initial data I got started to come out more on Darwin's side. I mean, I changed my views because of the findings. And then when I went to, I knew that the only way I was going to get definitive evidence was to study people who had no contact with the outside world. So you couldn't say any similarities were due to John Wayne and Charlie Chaplin rather than their evolutionary heritage. So I went to work in a Stone Age culture in New Guinea and did get the evidence. That was in 1967 and 68. Long time ago, there still were isolated cultures. They don't exist anymore. But more generally, I started to do it once I knew that Darwin was right. He was right on both things. He said expressions are universal and gestures are culture-specific, language-like, and that's correct too. So things like this, which may mean A-OK, it's a very vulgar insult in Sicily. Totally different meaning with the same movement. And there are a number of others. If you're not a German, you don't know I just said good luck.
Okay? No, I don't.
Holding thumbs. When I grew up as a kid, that was good luck.
Yeah.
And nobody uses it anymore. The current kids don't use that. These things go in and out of...
That means I'm lying.
If it's behind your back, it means I'm lying. Okay. And if it's in front, it's good
luck. We'll get to lying after a while.
So, more generally, taking a perspective that part of what we do is and how we behave, particularly when it comes to the area of emotion, is the result of phylogenetic influences. I take the radical position that if it only exists in humans, it can't be an emotion. Emotions are shared with other animals, and how we behave in part reflects our phylogenetic history, our history as hunters and gatherers, and part superimposed on that structure, on those proclivities, are what we learn in the first years of life. So it's both. In that sense, we're all different because we have different first years of laws. But we do share some of this common material that reflects our history on the planet and our phylogenetic history. And that's in the area of emotion. Now, if we go into the area of cognition, thoughts, I mean, we are the only animal that we know of that uses symbols to represent plans, actions, feelings, etc. It's a giant change. Now, words are
evolutionary change.
Yes, and it's like the opposable thumb. You know, you look at other animals, and you do find things that look like fingers, but that opposable thumb means you can do all kinds of things that you can't do without it. And with words, you can reflect upon, you can plan ahead, because you can think about what isn't happening right now. You've got the symbols to do so. Best as we know, no other animal can do that.
And we've only had that capability maybe 40, 50,000 years. It's not like we came into being Homo sapiens with language.
That's right.
Even that is an evolutionary moment.
Yes, it is. And it's got It can distract us. It can remove us. But it's a great tool for use by in an intelligent way for our emotions, for understanding our emotions.
I'm sorry. And it can get in our way.
And it can get in our way because we can become totally preoccupied with the words and the thoughts and lose touch with our feelings. I have some evidence that the more education you have, the more likely it is that you won't know how you're feeling.
Really?
Yeah, you're going to
because
have, you're going to because you are in the your mind, you're in the thoughts, you're in the planning, you're not in the moment. And you've got all these wonderful tools for being anywhere but in the moment.
That's humbling.
So I wanted to tell you about this dream I had with Darwin.
Yes, indeed.
So he said, I'm so delighted with what you've done with this book. And incidentally, I met two of Darwin's great-great-grandsons after the third edition that I edited was out, and they loved it. Because what I did was I put over 100 commentaries from a modern perspective inserted in his text. And the Times Literary Supplement said there are two books. There's Darwin's book and Ekman's book within Darwin's book. But it isn't really my book within it. It's my commentary on what he said that for the reader brings you up to date.
And gives you the data that was unavailable to him.
Him, right. And lets you know when his guesses were right. About 90% of the time they were. It's pretty good.
Well, I only bring Darwin up because of this whole profound importance of environment.
But I want to come back still.
To the dream? I want you to.
I have a dream.
And you want to share it.
I had a dream. Is that West Side Story? Where is I Had a Dream?
I think it's Martin Luther King.
I have a dream.
at the Lincoln Memorial would be my guess. But let's.
Oh, no, that Martin Luther King said, I have a dream, but there's a song, I Had a Dream.
I don't know, Paul, but okay. Let's go back to the dream.
So
okay?
Back to the dream. So Darwin says, thank you so much for what you've done to bring my book back to public attention. But the afterwards that you've written in the book, it's over 100 pages. Don't you think that's a little long for my book? So I cut it in half. And the other half has still never been published because I haven't, it was a discussion of the nature of signals. And I haven't really figured out where in the world, what am I going to ever do with that?
I don't know that anybody has had quite such an intimate relationship with Darwin in the last 10 or 15 or 20 years.
I had to take it literally.
Yeah.
I did.
That's good advice, too.
It's good advice. Yeah. I mean, really. 50-page afterward is enough.
Okay, back to the environment.
Now, Darwin has, my recent, it's only the last 10 years, because of my daughter, I would never, this is serendipity again. Not that I have a daughter is not serendipity, but my getting to know the Dalai Lama and getting interested in his thinking and his approach is all because of my daughter, who I introduced to him as my spiritual leader. She no longer has much interest in Buddhism, but I got...
But when she was in high school?
When she was in high school, she spent a summer. We thought she was just going trekking for a bunch of other kids and a teacher in Nepal. But they spent 2 weeks, each kid in a different Tibetan refugee family's home. And so she came back all fired up about Free Tibet. And Eve is an activist. She organized the largest high school Free Tibet club in America and got to meet the Dalai Lama briefly. And I had always thought, well, he preaches nonviolence like Gandhi, like King. Must be a good person. But Buddhism seemed to me just another Bay Area cult, and I had nothing to do with the cults.
But you were in the Bay Area, so you knew wherever you spoke.
That's right. I knew I'd seen them come and go. But I knew if you got invited, he was very interested in Western science, and if you got invited to meet with him, you got to bring one silent observer. I thought, wouldn't that be a treat for my daughter? So I put my name in. They invited me. I brought her, and he and I inexplicably connected. And he wrote about that in one of his most recent books, The Universe in a Single Atom, that he felt this immediate connection. More recently, he's told me, we were brothers in a previous incarnation, and I can't explain it. I mean, in the Western terms, we'd say it's a deja vu. When I met him, I felt like I'd always known him. And so he's very amused that he can explain it and I can't. but when I met with him earlier today, I gave him my interpretation of reincarnation. We were holding hands at that point, and I put another hand, and I said, "Now, I don't want this to offend you, but here's how I interpret reincarnation as a Western scientist. That it's a brilliant metaphor, almost 2,600 years old, for the idea that when we enter the world, we're not tabula rasa. When we enter the world, we are in part of our story is already written. Now, they didn't know at that time that how the past influences the present, but it does, and it does it through genes. So we have now discovered the mechanism that shows the influence of the past. So then we got into a very interesting thing, because if you take people who show what I call heroic compassion, it's one of four types of compassion that I'm distinguishing now, that I talked with him about both in the book, but I've changed the positions a little bit. Would you expect, if you have heroic compassion, if you're the person who jumps into the subway and pulls that person out without thought, a total stranger, or rescues a total stranger from the pond, perhaps losing your own life so they don't drown, would you find in their family line, in their grandparents, or uncles, or aunts, cousins, would you find others who have this proclivity? No, says the Dalai Lama, because it's not genes, it's past karma. Yes, says Paul Ekman, it's genes. So we now have a way to test this two different ways of interpreting past influence.
Paul Ekman finds ways to test things as a Western scientist that just blow me away. So Bill Russell and I will be blown away again. When we come back in just a moment, we trust you'll be with us too.